Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really happy today to have this opportunity to speak with Prexy Nesbitt. Prexy lives in Chicago and is just passing through the Cisco Bay area here. And I really appreciate your fitting me into your busy schedule, Prexy. I want to let people know that you have been active in the movement for social change and social justice all your adult life, and especially matters concerning Africa. And we're going to leave this interview kind of open-ended because you have had so much experience, been so many places, done so many things, and we just have this time to talk. I know you've both recently been living, before you went back to Chicago, been living in Africa. So if you want to start out there, that's great. And then, you know, talk to us about what's on your mind.
Thank you, Sue. I'm happy to be here. I was living in southern Africa, living precisely in South Africa, Johannesburg, until roughly January of 2002. And since January of 2002, I've been traveling all over the United States, doing a lot of organizing on southern African issues, both for Africa Action organization based in Washington, D.C., and also for the American Friends Service Committee, where I served as the interim director of their Africa program. I guess the focus of much of my work over the last year in this country has been to try to keep Africa visible and the issues that Africa is facing before the American people. It's a big challenge because I think since the elections in South Africa in 1994 and since the period of Nelson Mandela's presidency, that much of the understanding and information and coverage of Africa really disappeared. People sort of just then assumed that everything was going well in Africa and that therefore there was no longer any need for real attention to be paid to Africa. And I think nothing could be further from the truth. It strikes me, and I think many of the organizations that I've worked with, that Africa is facing today a crisis that is unmatched anywhere else in the world. And it is one that is what I would call the real threat of terror in the world. I have been living in South Africa and have traveled to all the bordering countries and have traveled to East Africa and West Africa. And I can say without any exaggeration that we see a situation in Africa today where there's somewhere around 6,000 people dying per day, where you had last year somewhere close to 3 million deaths. And I think that this is illustrates the crisis that Africa is under today. Of course, a lot of this stems from what is called the HIV/AIDS pandemic that Africa is facing. But one cannot understand that pandemic unless you understand also the general war of poverty and deprivation that all of Africa faces. It stems from different sources. The first source it stems from is a history that Africa yet is having to deal with of exploitation by big multinational corporations like Chevron, for example. It is the history also of being used, that a lot of which stemmed out of the Cold War, so that the wars and civil conflicts, civil military conflicts that you read of today, Sierra Leone, that you read of in places like Liberia, these are rooted in the Cold War. Essentially, they are products of the Cold War, and they are products of the fact that the United States is one of the largest providers of weaponry to the world, unmatched, nowhere supplies as much weaponry as what the United States does. And then lastly, It's this issue of debt. And as Bishop Tutu often has said, debt is the new way that Africa has become enchained. And I tell you, as one who has watched and been involved with issues related to Africa for the last 40 years, I think it's very tragic to see Africa now kind of going into a down cycle, despite all the incredible efforts that people in Africa make, that is rooted in much bigger things that Africa is up against. Though that's my preoccupation. And in the meanwhile, what you see in this country, in the United States particularly, is that you see nothing but the sort of continued Tarzanization of Africa. I just saw the other day a film that was, it's a scandal. It's a scandal that the film would even show. It was called Tears from Heaven or something like that. And it's just a kind of modernization of the Tarzan myth.
So Far from Heaven? Was
so
it?
Far from Heaven. No, not So Far from Heaven. It's Tears from the Sun. It's a film based in supposedly a kind of Nigeria. It's the story of a mercenary going over to Africa. And I think that one of the things that I'm also struggling against in this country, Sue, is to struggle against what I call the Tarzanization of Africa. And it's this myth-making and projection of Africa that is around Africa only being important insofar as white lives are concerned with Africa, or insofar as sort of Hollywood projects white key figures. I mean, the key film, of course, is Out of Africa, is a sort of more recent version of this Tarzan projection. But what it ends up with is this abysmal ignorance that's not unrelated to the kind of ignorance that we show in general about foreign affairs in this country, but that is particularly acute when it comes to racial questions, because then the racial order also intercedes to make knowledge of Africa even more profoundly absent in terms of the psyche of the American people. So what I'm trying to contend with repeatedly all over is battling against this sort of blankness that exists around things having to do with Africa in the United States. And of course, then that leads to further marginalization of Africa. And given the kind of mad, frightening war, permanent war perspective that the current administration that I call the yellow horned vultures and the hyena man, that this current administration is projecting will mean Africa will suffer even more because it will be non-existent.
Right. Yeah, now it's just the Middle East. That's the only part of the world that exists. That's well, not only, and there's always Europe.
Exactly, and Europe. But even then, I think that one of the things that one could say is that if the HIV/AIDS pandemic was to be impacting a European country at the same intensity within which it is impacting Black Africa, we would know all about it. We would be doing tons of things about it. But because it's involving people of color, Black people, there's nothing being done, really, especially nothing out of the damned administration. When Bush, in a most cynical way, most cynical maneuver, in the State of the Union address, made mention that he was getting ready to do this $18 billion worth of contribution to the HIV/AIDS crisis in Africa, that was a total smoke and mirrors announcement. There's no such intention. He simply manipulated some figures. He didn't say to people that as he would do that, he would also be destroying the most effective vehicle for working with the HIV/AIDS crisis, which is the Global Fund for Africa. And that because of the Bush administration not giving the minimum of $2 billion that fund needs, it's in dire economic predicament. It may not survive this period. And that's the most efficient, the best vehicle for working with the pandemic. Bush deliberately, as part of their general policy of not working with any multilateral institutions, deliberately did not give to that entity the money it needs to exist, and at the same time made it appear as if he was making these great moves, great gesture. And that was just part of trying to counter this image that the rest of the world has of this country and this administration is just callous, brutal, and indifferent to the world. He used Africa, in other words. There's no intention to really help Africa. It was to use Africa to kind of put the U.S. better in a better light.
Well, it fits in with a lot of things that Bush is doing in terms of taking money out of anything that would help people and putting it into killing people, basically, in a nutshell. Absolutely. And telling lies.
And telling lies. And I think that's the other thing that I would say to you, Sue, that I am very struck with. You know, there's a wonderful book that came out some years ago called Lies My Teacher Taught Me. And I really recommend it to people. It's a very, very important book, a very important statement. And one of the things that I think is the most impressive to me in this period and around this horrible war, this imperial war that we're seeing emerge.
The war on the world.
The war on the world is the extent to which the American people are being duped by lies. That's the big lie, for example, about what really took place on 9/11 and the involvement. Clearly there must be involvement of the United States intelligence agencies and others in that. It just too much fits the modus of operation of that history. And anybody who's followed the history of intelligence agencies and of U.S. intervention all over the world, it just fits the pattern. There's that lie. Then there's the lie that is projected that this is this utter land of utter democracy, you know. For me, coming from the city of Chicago, I think we just laughed about that always. You know, you grow up in a city where you know that there is no real democratic process because a political machine made the fundamental decisions about voting. You grow up knowing that money is what would really make for the possibility of elections. And of course, then the world, you go out in the world and they want to know in the world, well, how could it be that this man who's your president bought his election? You know, he maneuvered to get that election with the help of his brother down in Florida. It's another major lie. And then of course there's the lie that that this system has provided health care and provides education and that people live together in a multicultural society here in the country, when in fact what one sees is a deepening polarization, racial and ethnic polarization all over the country. These are all parts of the lie, the big lie, that sadly one finds the American people being so duped by at this period. And I've been very fortunate to have been a lot outside of this country and to get other media and other information other than what you would get on the big dominant monopoly media channels here in this country, so that you get the real truth about situations as opposed to get what is fed you in the United States. And I think that in fact we are, the United States is an ultimate master in propaganda and running a propaganda machinery around news and information here in this country. And I think these are things that most Americans simply don't get.
Absolutely. I just saw yesterday a documentary, the first half of a documentary that talked about, oh, of course, I can't remember this guy's name, but he was the nephew of Freud, of Sigmund Freud, and the whole beginning of public relations. They didn't want to call it propaganda, so they called it public relations. And the whole buildup of consumerism and playing on people's needs and desires and making them need, you know, want things that they don't need and manipulating their mind. So it goes back. I already knew a lot about it, and I was really astounded. And it is important for people to be able to look critically at how they're being manipulated, because that is really such a key thing. I want to remind people that my guest is Prexy Nesbitt. Ms. Prexy has been working on issues related to Africa and lots of other social issues for many years. You said something, Prexy, about the divide between races or black and white. I don't know exactly how you put it, was getting bigger. Now, I know that the gap in terms of money is growing a lot, And what else were you speaking of, especially since you're from Chicago, not from here, and you yourself are African-American? I'm wondering what you notice, especially, and some people think things that as bad as they are have gotten better, and other people don't. What do you think?
Well, I think we're in this era where you have the Oprah show, and you have the legacy of Bill Cosby, and you have so many entertainers and sports figures, Magic Johnson and others, that all make it seem like you have a pattern of having growing numbers of interracial relationships and more and more children of color that are clearly mixed children, kind of the Benetton children, some people have referred to them in a kind of cynical way. Clearly that pattern has gone on, and clearly there are more mixed relationships. But the solid numbers of people in this country, in city after city after city, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Atlanta, Detroit, Seattle, Houston, Birmingham. I've been to all these places in the last year, and one of the things I'm struck by is what I call the growing social apartheid in this city, and where we are seeing the kind of rooting in and calcifying of relationships and patterns of living where people never see other groupings of people. I think it's particularly true along the racial lines of black, African-American people, and white people. It corresponds to class realities in the United States. It is also true with Latinos. It's also true with Asians. It's also true that those groups, African-Americans, Asians, Latinos, in many of these cities have minimal interaction with each other. It is, in effect, working out the thing that the apartheid system of South Africa never perfected, and that is working out a kind of ultimate opposing of these groups, so that they have no experience in any positive way with one another, no minimal capacity for working together and forming coalitions and building real, viable political vehicles that transcend race. And that's the purpose of this. And it strikes me that the other piece of it is that it corresponds so much with poverty and with poorness. And as you point out, the juxtaposition of poor and getting poorer in this country, the rich are getting richer, the numbers of people who are ultimately rich are getting to levels that are very, very frightening, the growing numbers of people who are beyond standard definitions of poor in the United States. And it's creating, I think, a new grouping that goes beyond race and class. They talk a little bit about it in a book about South Africa. I think the title of that book is called We Are the Poors. And I think we have a new grouping in the United States called the Poors that are beyond, some of them are third and fourth generation of ultimate poverty, beyond anything that we really are familiar with in the U.S. society, and it's never talked about, but it's happening all over the United States, and it's that group that is the group from which they draw as much surplus as they want out of them and then just dispose of them. I think of them as kind of a group that you could call superfluous people. They don't matter only in as much as you use them to work in a McDonald's or you use them in a Burger King or for dope. They are important for the dope industry and the distribution of dope all over this country. And that, it strikes, it's not an accident that that's such a source of important capital and formation of capital is coming out of this ultimate population that is so used and exploited and then ends up being the bulk of the prison population of this country. And it's not accidental that you just had a figure reached of 2 million people incarcerated. And you tie into this industry another industry, which is the industry of building prisons. I live part of the year in rural Wisconsin, and there where small family farms have disappeared, the new source of employment for those white rural Wisconsin people is taking care of human beings. It's like they're the new slave catchers. They're the new runners of the slave plantation. And those rural white people are just victimized in this whole thing. They have no idea. They have no understanding of how deeply they have become embedded in one of the most vicious systems that we know. And it's not accidental that you have a president who comes from a state that is the penultimate in terms of this whole system of that ends up, it starts out with superfluous appendages, you add in dope, you add in people being imprisoned, and then you have capital punishment, and then we have a president that is representative of all of that.
And let's not forget who brings the drugs into this country, and not get that mixed up with the small drug dealers.
Absolutely. Remember this whole episode in Los Angeles. It's now disappeared from sort of people's screens with the Contras and the whole exchange of the Contras getting weapons to the Contras and selling the dope and the CIA being behind the whole thing. I think most people now have forgotten altogether that the CIA head had to appear before a South Central Los Angeles audience trying to defend himself against the engagement of the CIA in all of that affair. These are important things.
They are, and there's lots of evidence of lots of drugs being brought in all the time by the military, the CIA. And you can find out about it on the internet, actually, at COPVCIA, at that website, COPVCIA. I wanted to mention, too, that I've heard that I think it's 1/4 of the children in the United States go to bed hungry. And, of course, and you're talking about people being wasted between the prisons, which you're talking about, and all the people on the streets, too. And it really... Well, you've just been talking about it. I just want to add in those little statistics there because I think a lot of people don't know about it because we are so many people are so manipulated.
And then you add that 40 million people who are without any health care coverage, you know, and then you end up with a style of life in this country that is so insecure and so frightening for people. But the lie that's out there in the world is that this is the greatest place in the world to live. So I've traveled in parts of Eastern Europe where Eastern Europeans are just desperate to come to the United States. And it's interesting, Sue, I've met many who've come here and who haven't experienced here the great life that they thought they would have here. The lie kind of came up against the reality. And it's interesting to me to see that many of them find themselves very rejecting of the other white populations they meet in these cities that have been around and have gone into the kind of racialized games that go on. And these more recent Eastern European immigrants identify very quickly with African Americans, with Latinos, with Native Americans, because they have themselves begun to experience exploitation and repression. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
Yeah. And they recognize it probably from their own experience more quickly.
Precisely.
I wanted to say, too, it's when you're saying it's an apartheid system, and I totally agree with everything you're saying, except that I do want to say that the demonstrations here, the anti-war demonstrations here in San Francisco and Oakland have been really thrilling to me in that they have really reflected the population in terms of who's there, in terms of age and ethnicity. And that's been just wonderful to see. And I don't know that it's that way other places, but it's been wonderful to see because we do live here. I think Oakland is supposed to be the most multi-ethnic city in the country or the world or something like that. And yet, you know, you walk on the streets and you see all kinds of people and it looks like everybody's together. But, of course, that doesn't mean that they relate. But it's been very heartwarming to see this at the demonstration.
I can totally understand that and appreciate it. I think that one of the things that this kind of ultimate system of divide and rule, that ultimately people begin to see through it. And the people themselves, and I'm a great believer in getting information to people And people will then organize, and they will resist if they understand. That's why this system spends so much to keep information from people, to keep them just given nonsensical, the lie, the big lie. But I think the American people have a great capacity to resist once they understand what's really taking place.
Well, we just have this little teeny bit amount of time left, but do you see that happening?
I do, Sue. I see it happening all over the country. There's tremendous amounts of resistance and struggle on many fronts and in many sectors taking place. And one of the things that we in the left are challenged to do is to create more vehicles that we let each other know more of what we're doing in these different struggles so that we learn from each one. The South Africans used to say all the time, each one teach one. We've got to keep more vehicles going of sharing information, sharing experiences of struggle. We have now the technological capacities for doing that. We need to develop more ways that we actually use that technological capacity to do that sharing.
And who knows how long this technological capacity is going to last.
Available.
So we also need to make personal relationships.
Oh, that's the crucial, the bottom line of struggling. The bottom line is building relationships. And, of course, that's also part of this global apartheid. Incidentally, I urge your readers to all look at the systematic write-up of what I've been talking about that's been done by Bill Minter and Sally Booker in an article called Global Apartheid that appeared in The Nation magazine. Just a brilliant, brilliant exposition on this whole subject matter. Of course, they don't go into all the depth you and I have gone into, but they lay out this whole system of inequities that we yet are facing and struggling against that at bottom is about capitalism and it's about imperialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the things that the propaganda has made so many Americans think that capitalism and democracy are the same thing.
Absolutely. They think it's the synonymous terms, when in fact, I think this is the one thing I'd thank the old Mayor Daley and the more recent Daley for in growing up on the west side of Chicago. You grew up understanding that democracy wasn't necessarily what was really out there in this American society.
Mm-hmm. Well, Prexy Nesbitt, thank you very, very much for your time and this interview. I know you have a busy time in your short stay out here in California, so thanks so much.
Sue, thank you, and I'm glad to finally get on your show because I've heard a lot of good things. We need a couple Sue Suprianos in the Chicago area.
Sweet. Well, I hope you get some good independent media out there. And indeed, my name is Sue Supriano. Thank you very much for listening. To order a copy of the program you just heard, write down the following information. The email is sue@suesupriano.com. That's Sue, S-U-E, at Sue Supriano, S-U-E-S-U-P-R-I-A-N-O.com. Or the telephone is 510-883-1979. That's 510-883-1979.